Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. My name is Michael Walker, and I'm here with my co-host, Mark. How are you this week, Mark?
I'm quite well, thanks. How are you?
I'm getting there.
You're getting there? Where's there, Walker?
It was just a really good game, really good week for games, Mark. I'm here.
But you're here. You're getting there.
Soon.
But last week was a good week.
Yes.
So you were in a good place. You're getting to a bad place? Is that what's going on?
I think so.
I'm very confused. I was good. Now I'm confused.
We're going to talk about the games that we played last week. Then we're going to talk about some news and why it doesn't matter. And then we will talk about our feature game, which is Ascending Empires Zenith Edition. Specifically Zenith Edition.
Well, I'll be talking about the original edition as well.
But yes.
I'm an incorrigible historical digressor.
So, Mark, what did you get to play this week?
Got to play Guards of Atlantis with the Arcane Hero Pack. There are some new heroes in Guards of Atlantis 2, and this is very much in keeping with a lot of Wolf Designer's second editions. They just replaced all of the cards from everything. And now what you have is effectively every hero from the base game has gone through 3 different versions. And I love watching an idea evolve. And the characters in Guards of Atlantis are sufficiently fleshed out and sufficiently robust and are trying to evoke a specific thing in MOBA-style gaming, an area of video gaming that I have some exposure to but not a great deal of experience with, that I'm nonetheless able to appreciate the evolution of these ideas. Now, case in point, the hero that I took was Sabina the Gunslinger, who can basically spec out to be a push-oriented character or an assassin-oriented character, largely by virtue of how she manipulates the minions on the board. Minions and Guards of Atlantis, you don't tend to mess with other than killing them. That's by and large what they're there for. But some characters, like Sabina, have abilities that allow them to move around. And in the early rounds of this game of Guards of Atlantis, I was able to do that in a very, very obnoxious way. Namely, someone would spend their movement to get next to a minion with the clear intent of then killing it. And then on the same turn, I'd be like, oh, okay, that minion is just going to move out the way. Which can be extraordinarily frustrating and made me happy, and I giggled like a small child.
I knew you probably would.
But then there's the
question...
Why
should someone want to have fun? I'm just joking.
Wow. I mean, I know that you're generally dispositionally a martyr.
No, no. I'm just saying
that's...
Guards of Atlantis. This is what you do. You need to,
it's what you do.
You need to know your dice. You need to know how to manipulate
your
the
deck.
Board.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Then when it came time to spec up, my natural inclination for Guards of Atlantis and games generally is to be a pusher. I like to push the lane, I like to dance with minions, but the problem was the needs of the game and the needs of my team clearly required me to become an assassin, and so that's what I did. Sabina has this attack option that allows you to target somebody within range, and if they have played an attack card this turn, the attack becomes very strong. And if you're buffed appropriately, and or if they're not buffed appropriately, and or if they're situated in a disadvantageous position from defense, this can be an unblockable attack if you play your cards right. And that's more or less what I did. I'd be in this position where this was a 3-on-3 game, and I had to just have the wherewithal and have the confidence to be within striking distance of all of my opponents at once and just play the attack card, knowing that one of them would probably mess up and play their own attack card in such a way that I could kill them. And that's what generated a lot of my momentum in the middle game, getting these opportunistic sniping kills with this build that I made. And it was glorious. I've loved seeing Sabina evolve. I think she's in a pretty good place. I think she was overpowered in the first edition. In the second edition, I couldn't quite get her to work properly. That was probably a me problem more than anything else. But now in this second edition revision of the second edition, the numbers get complicated. I think she's in a really good place. Now, my opponents... the three-team opponents, this was a very strange game other than that. All that was pretty straightforward, just the normal brilliance of Guards of Atlantis 2. It was our game of the year, the game it came out. It's a fabulous, fabulous game. We'll play it anytime. But our opponents, okay, so Guards of Atlantis 2, especially, is a very complicated game with very simple mechanisms. And you need, as Walker said, you need to know your character and you need to know your opponents. And a lot can hinge on one point of initiative, one point of spacing, one point of attack. It's a game of margins in a lot of ways. Our team of three, the total complexity rating, adding up the complexity ratings of all our characters, was 4. So two people took a 1, I took a 1 as well. I'm not comfortable taking 2s and 3s on specs, certainly no 4s, until I've got a little bit more comfort with what's going on, or sometimes I'll take them as a handicap. Our opponents took a total complexity of 11. So this is a complexity 4 against a complexity 11. This is what we would consider a gulf, a rift, a distance, a delta. And what's more, the three opponents we were facing, and this is for the diehards of Guards of Atlantis, were Mrak, Razzle, and Nebker. All three of them deposit impassable tokens on the board. There were several turns in which none of us on our team could move at all towards any objective worth anything because we were just trapped. And it was incredibly weird. We nonetheless managed to pull out, in part because they chose incredibly complicated characters. So yeah, they were very good at cluttering the board with garbage. But on one or two occasions, that same garbage prevented them from getting where they wanted to go as well, because it's impassable to them as well. Like Razzle in particular, I think is worth highlighting, because Razzle is sort of a circus harlequin, and what she does is she multiplies herself, and she triggers abilities, and suddenly there are 4 of her. And she's got this really big good defense card that increases her defense for every one of hers that gets removed, and that's great, but by the same token, Walker, there are 4 of her. That's 4 times as many targets. And as I just said, the way that my character worked was opportunistically sniping people. I was always drowning in targets. I never had a shortage of people to go after. Sometimes it wouldn't work, but I never really had to worry about the specifics of my board position too much. In part, that was great because, did I mention the board was full of garbage? It was weird. Pleasant, intriguing, illuminating, very weird. So that was our play of Guards of Atlantis. Some of the new characters, some of the new stuff. I am mostly going to be going to the characters that I know and love and seeing how they've changed. For example, Misa, the Sky Samurai, who I think was overpowered in the previous version. I'm looking forward to trying her new nerfed version, seeing how she works. Of course, she too is an opportunistic assassin. Maybe I should pick a character and just really lean into the farming thing if I possibly can, because that's where my heart is. I should really see if I can do that. Anyway. That's Guards of Atlantis 2, specifically with a whole bunch of new heroes from the Arcane Hero Pack and with some base game heroes with the updated stats. This is by Artem Nichapurov and Wolf Design of the expansions. The new expansions were released in 2024. Had a great time. Guards of Atlantis 2 continues to amaze. Always happy to play.
So this streaming day, we played two games that share sort of the same mechanism or the same theme of mechanism, which is everyone rolls dice at the same time, does stuff, and then the game moves on at a good pace. So the first one was Creature Caravan. We love Hyperborea because of the very interesting and cool creature cards that come up. So when this Ryan Lockett game was announced, that's the first thing that came to mind. Really cool creatures that you get to ride or that will pull your wagon. And sure enough, it gives you that in spades. It's this giant deck, and you're cycling through it. You start with 8 cards.
You're milling through the deck, perhaps? A giant deck through which you mill?
No, you don't. Maybe? You're not really searching for things. It's just it's so big, and you have such a free...
Oh, so none of the cards matter?
Nope. And there's so many things that let you just draw cards. You never have to discard any. Your hand limit is unlimited. And so you are trying to get across this landscape, but you don't have to get to the end. It's a bonus of 5 points if you get to the village at the end. You're also going to get 1 point for every space that you advanced, of which there are 25 to go across. And there's a bunch of zombies that are going to be chasing you down. But you're just trying to build this tableau of 12 cards, be they, followers that are with you or associates or guards that are helping you or animals that are pulling your stuff.
Creatures even.
Yeah, creatures even. It's that whimsical reveal That's what this game is. It's like, what is the next card going to be? And they all interact in some way. They all have all these keywords. Like, this is worth 1 point, but if you have five other tiny cards, then it's worth 20 points. And so, like, tons of different keywords. Another one was, you know, well, because you have this, none of your tiny creatures count as your 12. So Sidewinder had this, like, gigantic sideboard of, like, you know, 15 tiny creatures as well as our other board. So usually it would go quite quickly. Our game did not so much, but that's all right.
So here's a question. It sounds to me from this description that it feels an awful lot like almost every other Tableau Builder of the past 15 years.
Oh, for sure.
Like Fantasy Realms or Wingspan or 51st State or what have you. And if that's true, you're saying it largely gets by on charm.
100%.
Okay, and that's fine.
Yeah. That's the thing where, like I said, because you have an unlimited hand, you can discard as much as you want for bread, which is the main resource to putting out the other cards. But, and so you roll your five dice, you're allocating dice to do your actions, and then there's a whole bunch of extra actions that will now come up on some of your cards. Anyway, it's a very interesting game.
Is the dice allocation any good?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be something to perhaps differentiate it from a lot of other Tableau Builders.
Very glad I got it. It took a while. It's been out for a little bit, but I was like, oh, this is going to be... Again, but it was exactly what I wanted. Everyone had a good time, and that is Creature Caravan. The other one that was rolling dice at the same time, it's called Marvel Dice Throne. So there's Dice Throne that's out there. It's sort of like Attack Yahtzee, and it's very player interactive because you're just attacking each other. You're rolling dice, much like Yahtzee. You have three rolls to make your best hand, be it straights or pairs or whatever, and they're all referenced to different attacks. And that's paired up with a...
I'm told straights can form pairs.
Yes, that's paired up.
And not all pairs are straights, but, you know, straights can form pairs. And not all straights want to form pairs. That's fine, too.
It's true. Not all pairs are straights. It's paired with a card system. So, and the interesting part about that, it has a little, like, a Pokemon element to it, right? Because you have this giant player board that tells you about all the different dice combinations you have. And they're all abilities, like Punch, Pow, Energy Blast. But... within the deck is an upgrade card for each of those abilities. So it's like, okay, am I going to be able to cycle through to get those cards? Mm. Am I going to have enough currency to play them? And now that...
do you go from Energy Blast to Menergy Blast?
Just so.
Okay.
Menergy Blast! You know, they slightly better. It usually goes from like 6 points to 7 points. It's not this like crazy increase. Yeah, it's not great. But, you know, it's that feeling of now my thing's more powerful. Yeah. And yeah. So what we played was Marvel Dice Throne Missions. So it turns this interactive Yahtzee attack game into a cooperative Yahtzee attack game where you actually have figures and where you move around sometimes matters and you're picking up these benefits, you're getting beside minions, you're taking the minions down, you have a small mission to start with, kill X, get off the board, you flip the board over and there's the boss and you attack the boss. It was kind of neat. I like that type of thing. I think you really need to like the Yahtzee type games.
I see.
If you didn't like Dice Throne Missions is not going to be for you. It is exact. It's just more of the same. I did like Marvel Dice Throne. I played it once when we had it, and then just no one really wanted to get it to the table, so it sort of went by the wayside. But I wanted to give this a try because you can play it solo. So I got through one of the missions solo. It was pretty fun.
Well, it definitely seems that the player count becomes more flexible once you introduce missions. Question, can you use the non-Marvel Dice Throne characters in Dice Throne missions?
They have their own thing. They have Dice Throne Adventures. So I think they have their own cooperative thing.
Oh, okay. They go on adventures, they don't do missions?
I'm assuming so.
We're superheroes. We don't adventure. We do missions.
And the rules are fairly easy. And
I assume you played as Miles Morales.
Yes, of course.
Of course. Just the whole sure. thing.
You know, I didn't even play as Deadpool. I picked up the Deadpool pack just on a whim because it came with the actual figure. I didn't pay the billions of dollars that you could get, so you'd get like actual pre-painted figures of all the heroes.
I see.
I just had a standee.
Gross.
Gross. Which is on a side because it looks as though they had planned to put this out right from the beginning because the initial packs came with standees, which you didn't need.
Oh. All right, yeah, that's what we call
hell. It didn't come with stands for the standees, but it came with the standees.
Are you serious?
Yes.
That's wild.
And then when the missions came out, in case you just throughout the standees, because you had no idea what they were for.
Again?
They gave you like a generic set of, you know, yellow, blue, red standee. So and four stands. So now you have the stands for your standees.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And then it also leads into some of the other things, because some characters are made, you know, pretty specifically to attack each other. Like Huey played the Scarlet Witch, and she seemed to be mostly designed to play against another hero. So when she was fighting henchmen, the abilities didn't sort of blend that well.
Oh.
And I think on a subsequent play that she would not get used again.
I see.
But we'll see. It comes with a giant stack of villains that you can play against. I love the fact that it's like a quick flip, double-sided board. Lots to like about it. Very easy to learn. Both versions. Like even adding, it's not a huge rules load added on to get to missions.
Yeah, but it sounds like for a lot of people, the additional thematic trappings seem sufficiently abstracted that it's not going to overcome whatever feelings they might have about Yahtzee, as you say.
Yes, oh, for sure.
Fair enough.
And they did the great thing that we wish they did in the Sentinels board game. You move anywhere you want to.
Yeah.
There's no moving points. It's like move to whatever space you want. They did some things where the henchmen will block areas, so you have to kill them in order to get further. But there's no silly, you know, count spaces.
Mm, good time.
So, Creature Caravan is a Ryan Lockett game. So, all the artists is done by Ryan Lockett, and it's put out by his company, Red Raven Games. And Marvel Dice Throne is designed by Gavin Brown and Nate Chandler and put out by Roxley Games.
Play the second session of The Elder Scrolls Betrayal of the Second Era. So, this is the Chip Theory Games kind of sort of evolution of the Too Many Bones system into The Elder Scrolls. I have a fair degree of enthusiasm for The Elder Scrolls games. You know, Skyrim, Oblivion, Daggerfall, those. And I have a fair bit of enthusiasm for Too Many Bones, and so that I took a chance on The Elder Scrolls. And thus far, I've been very pleasantly surprised. It has displayed a degree of depth that a lot of the other Chip Theory Games offerings have not. We very strongly disliked Burn Cycle and rather significantly disliked Cloud Spire, and Hoplomachus was a total bust for me. But at any rate, The Elder Scrolls innovates on Too Many Bones in two significant ways. One, the overland part of the game, you know, going from fight to fight, is substantially more meaty, and you're progressing along an overland map. You can go to various cities, each of which has an entry in an appropriate gazetteer. There are random encounters, of course, but then there are side missions that you can accomplish that require you to go to specific kinds of places and do specific kinds of things. And I didn't feel like the overall structure of the game was just getting me to the next fight. Because as much as I like the combat system in Too Many Bones, a typical session of Too Many Bones will have you have about half a dozen combats, sometimes more, sometimes less. But you're ultimately just spending a lot of time setting up and tearing down the same combat over and over, because each combat has an increasing number of enemies, broadly speaking. And it just becomes surprisingly tedious to fish out the relevant enemies, form the relevant queue, make sure they have the appropriate initiative marker on them, set the dice on the initiative track, make sure they have the appropriate hit point stack, and then put them on the map. You do that about, I don't know, 5 to 10 times, you start to get tired of it, and then you have to do it another 20 to 30 times after that. And so it just gets a little tedious. Another issue that Too Many Bones tends to have, and I was explaining this to Illupo, the person I've been playing Elder Scrolls with who has not played Too Many Bones, is that the smart play in Too Many Bones is almost always, when leveling up, to just get more attack dice. And that's not fun, because every character in Too Many Bones has 16 unique toys that they can play with. It's just much of the time, not always, but much of the time, you shouldn't play with them, because that's not the smart move. So whenever I'm playing Too Many Bones, I just feel like I'm deliberately playing suboptimally, which is fine. I'm willing to do it. It just feels like I'm at tension with the game design itself. So in The Elder Scrolls, you don't have asymmetric characters. What you have is an asymmetric racial archetype. The Elder Scrolls has not moved past the sort of race science of role-playing games of the 20th century. And you kind of have a class, but the class doesn't matter a whole heck of a lot. What really matters is your skill lines. And there's a whole bunch of different skills, each of which have their own rules. Each skill might have something like 5-ish different custom dice that each do their own things. Each custom die might have as many as 2 or 3 different unique results on them, all of them well-referenced. I never felt overwhelmed by the iconography. Everything made sense, but everything's just really cool. And so my character is an Imperial archer who, when times get really tough, pulls out a two-handed sword and yells at creatures and commands them to fight on her behalf. And this is great. I felt like I was given a fair degree of latitude to do whatever it is that I wanted to do. Would I have liked to have picked up, say, illusion magic? Yeah. Did I have the opportunity to? Not really. So the game was giving me enough constraint to guide me in a way so I won't necessarily take the same skills all the time, but I'm getting to play around in a relatively large toolbox. All that stuff is great. The character customization, playing with the different characters, wonderful. The Overland stuff, I think, is pretty good. It's kind of there. It doesn't inject a whole lot of narrative into things, but it gives you a nice superstructure to move your party around the map and decide where and when you're going to be fighting your battles, so that part's okay. I've never been particularly impressed with the world building of the Elder Scrolls games, either in PC version or in this, so in that sense, it's consistent. I have two major misgivings about the Elder Scrolls board game. Number one is the length. So the first session we played, every campaign is supposed to be 3 sessions. The first session we played was about 4.5 hours. And a lot of that was just struggling with the rules presentation because there's a whole bunch of different subsystems that you have to wrestle with at any given time. None of it's particularly complicated, but issues like, okay, we're on the Overland map. At what point do the universe specific rules kick in? We were in the Black Marsh for the first session. We were in High Rock for the second. So at what point do we trigger the world specific effect? Okay, check the chart at the beginning of the gazetteer. Oh, but I'm later on in the gazetteer. Okay, bookmark that. Go back to the origin. How far do we move? Under what conditions? When do we move? And then when we stop, what happens first? The rewards phase or the other thing? Okay, go check that. And then you start a fight. And then there's all the same niggles about ordering and things. It's just a lot. There's a lot of details to get right, even though none of it is particularly obnoxious, and I just wanted to make sure I knew what I was doing. They recommend that you go use the Dised app. I can't remember, Walker, have you ever used the Dised app? It's weird. It is better than if you need to word search a rules document. I find that it's pretty okay, because for whatever reason, searching a PDF document has not gotten significantly better over the course of the past, 30 years that everyone's been using PDFs. It's weird. You'd figure with the amount of processing power available in everyone's pockets, we'd be able to do word search on a 200 kilobyte PDF in no time flat. But alas, we're not there yet. So if what you want to do is you have the app already open and you want to do a word search of a document, it's pretty good. In any other context, it's sluggish and strange and weird and laggy, and I don't like it.
Isn't that the one that also walks through, like, in tutorials of the game as well?
Yes, there are tutorializations for various games that I haven't messed with as much. I don't really like the tutorialization of things, because then, I don't have a sense of where to look things up. But I guess if you're going to be spending your entire time in the Dised architecture, you don't need to know where to look things up, because you're only ever going to be using the keyword search. Okay, fine, maybe.
Is this a free app?
It is a free app, yes.
All right, interesting. Yeah.
But as somebody who actually read the rules and found the physical rules presentation reasonably okay for the most part, I'm using this as a supplement, and there we are. Another misgiving that I have about the Elder Scrolls is that I'm a little confused about the difficulty scaling. So this is one of the areas where the progenitor Too Many Bones is very clearly visible. The default amount of enemy points you have is the number of day number you're on times the number of experience points you have. If this is day 3 and you've got 11 experience points, well then you fight 33 points of monsters. And there are various strengths of monster in various stacks, and you just pull so that you have the fewest number of monsters imaginable possible. So with 33, you'd pull a 20, 2 fives, and then 3 ones. That's how you'd make the queue. The difficulty 20 monsters are weird. They're very strange. Like, in Too Many Bones, I would look at a difficulty 20 monster and say, oh yeah, that is a badass. That knows what it's doing. It's going to mess you up. The difficulty 20 enemies in The Elder Scrolls are kind of weird and unsatisfying. And I'm not really sure what's going on. Like, I felt like in Session 2, we weren't significantly stepping up the adversaries that we were fighting. We had a lot more skills. We had a lot more things around the corner. We weren't really getting a huge amount more powerful. We were getting significantly more powerful, but mostly we were gaining in options. And then the enemies kept scaling up, but it didn't feel like they were getting harder. It's very strange. When the difficulty scales up in Too Many Bones, I feel it. The difficulty scaling in Elder Scrolls, it's early days yet, but I find it a little odd, and I don't know if I'm alone in this. So Are we significantly intrigued so that we want to play the third session? Absolutely. I'm down for it. I like my character. I like what they get to do. And I'm enjoying the battles. And I'm enjoying the Overland stuff enough. And the second session, to refer back to the first objection, was only 3 hours. And we were playing at a relatively leisurely pace. The difference between 3 hours and 4.5 hours is a lot, in my experience. It's far more than the 50% that you would imply. 2 to 3 hours, that's a significant, you know, you have to plan for it. You got to do it, but it's not an all-day thing. The moment you get past four, you have to start worrying about when dinner is, and it's a whole thing. I apologize for being such a middle-aged man, but there it is. So, The Elder Scrolls Betrayal of the Second Era, I find an interesting distillation of a lot of what was going on in Too Many Bones. And it does its license justice enough, but then again, as I say, mostly what I like about the license is the sense of freedom of character customization. And so the board game absolutely does that. And Ilupo and I are interested in going back for a third. I would even be willing to start another campaign with somebody else if they wanted to. I was surprised by how seamless a lot of it was. The setup, the teardown, relatively straightforward, relatively easy. A lot fewer rules questions the second session. Things just went along at a decent clip. So far I'm very impressed, I have to say, all told. I think as a product, I think Chip Theory Games has learned a lot. They still insist on using the strange slippery cards that I really don't see the need for, and they still make us do the thing that nobody should ever make us do, Walker. Don't make me shuffle neoprene.
Oof.
You can't shuffle neoprene. Stop making me shuffle neoprene, guys. Anyway, that's The Elder Scrolls Betrayal of the Second Era. I gotta say, all told, I'm very pleasantly surprised. I was not expecting much, but I've come out very, very impressed. And it might obsolete Too Many Bones in my collection. Really? I gotta say, as it's currently sitting, I'm just saying, like, there might or might not be an event sometime in July 25th, 26th, 27th, where I'm getting rid of all the games that I don't want to keep anymore. I'm just saying that there may be a trove chest full of the complete set of Too Many Bones that's there to be gotten rid of. I see people talking on the Discord. I see people speculating as to what we're doing and why. Yes, we are clearing out the trash in our game collections, but we're also clearing out some really good stuff in our game collections. How dare they? How dare they?
Always turn their nose up at free stuff, apparently.
The audacity. So that's The Elder Scrolls, Betrayal of the Second Era, and some of my grievances.
Mark, you and I got to play Dungeon Cart. I like a lot of racing games. You like quite a few racing games. And this came out in crowdfunding, and it looked like sort of a Mario Kart racing type. Had a lot of good things going for it. Luckily, a local got it, and so I got to borrow it, and we got it to the table. And I think for sort of a family weight game, I think it does a lot.
Family weight, really? Huh.
I think the movement is fairly dead simple. You move your gear shift up or down. You must move it. And then you move spaces equal to that. You're limited to how many times you're allowed to turn or drift. I think like a family that plays board games. I don't think like a day one board game, family game. But
maybe. No, it's just the reason why I push back on it being family weight is it strikes me as the kind of thing that requires a little bit more planning than I associate with family weight games. And if you don't do that planning, you are going to crash. And if you crash, you're just going to go very, very slowly. And I suspect that would lead to some people, particularly younger gamers or people with a low frustration threshold, to not enjoy Dungeon Cart.
True, but everyone's crashing. Like, crashing sounds bad, but a lot of crashing is happening, unfortunately. You know, you play a card, you make someone crash. You bump somebody into a wall, they crash. Lots of crashing.
Yeah, I know, but like that level of stepping back and saying, yeah, I crashed, but it's not a big deal. Very much like how any reasonable adult would be able to take a step back from civilization and say, yes, I got hit by superstition this turn, but all told, I'm moving to a good clip. Of course, any civilized person would do that, Walker. But nonetheless, taking that step back is often the kind of thing that family weight games cannot ask of an audience.
It's true. So it was fairly bog standard. There wasn't very much. There are some interesting things in Dungeon Cart. There was the gear shift where if you move through a certain train type, those train types were listed on your gear shift. And if you move through any of them, you gear down to the slowest one. In theory, that sounded very interesting. Unfortunately, in gameplay, it didn't really pan out because like the dirt one, which is the one that we were hitting more often, was so high up.
Yeah.
It just did not matter. The other interesting part about it was that you would draw all of these hazards, and some of the hazards would be like
adventurers
and heroes, and there would be like druids or necromancers, and they'd all have their own special rules, mostly just during setup, so you wouldn't have to, you know, constantly reference it or anything. So it wasn't a huge pain, like the druid put out a big
pile of grass that would block part of the thing. Necromancer would have zombies, and the shinobi had a big cloud of smoke that you had to go through. That was kind of interesting. But overall, it just didn't really bring much to the table.
It was reasonably cute, yeah. But I agree. It felt an awful lot like Mario Kart in some of the worst ways as well. Like you pull these spells, which are these one-shot cards that you can play, and a lot of them are just very, very blunt catch-up mechanisms. Like, play this card, everyone ahead of you crashes. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Fine, whatever. I mean, it's part of the genre. I'm not going to quibble too much. But in terms of satisfying race elements, I did see Huey pull off some interesting turns. I will say that. You know, he'd find a way with the combination of the way the track was laid out and with his drifting capabilities to find really cool shortcuts that I thought were neat. And that was kind of interesting. Unfortunately, it did not triumph over my blunt force drive in straight line real fast. So that also doesn't speak terribly well towards it. I mean, I would have liked just another little bit of something to make me care about what was going on in a mechanical way. Like, yeah, as a spectacle, it's fine. You're moving around the track, people crash, haha, it's fine. But as you say, the terrain limitation on your gear shift doesn't really matter a whole heck of a lot. The decision of whether to gear up or down wasn't particularly fraught. It was reasonably straightforward based on where you were on the track. It didn't have something like the hand management that you found in Charioteer or various other clever card manipulations you might have in something like Mush Mush or Snow Tails or what have you. And those are the kinds of things that I like in my racing games, honestly. And so it was all right. It was okay to play.
I'm glad I played it once. Yeah. I'm glad I didn't pay for it. But it's put out by Brotherwise Game and designed by Michael Zerwer.
Yeah, it's in the Boss Monster universe. I have not played Boss Monster, have you?
No.
Yeah, I get the sense that it would not be my kind of game, but who knows? I don't mean to slander it unnecessarily. We played another game of Star Trek Captain's Chair. I really wanted to play this again because this is by Nigel Buckle and David Surtse. They of Imperium and Voidfall, two of my favorite hobbyist games of the past few years. Really stellar designs, no pun intended. And I just find Imperium to be relentlessly rewarding and relentlessly interesting. And I will happily play it any day of the week. And I will play it solo. It's that well done. And Star Trek Captain's Chair is pretty much Imperium, but Star Trek-y and limited to a two-player game. And I was, I have to say, very disappointed. Overall, my thoughts are kind of solidifying. I'd play it again if people are interested in, but I didn't get the sense that you were particularly jibed. The terminology changes are often just not particularly interesting. Sometimes they even serve to obscure what's going on. The card play now is more convoluted than interesting. Every card has about three or four different effects, many of them very situational, and many of them very useful only to set up the thing, to set up the other thing, to set up the other thing, which pays off in a relatively minor Benny later on down the road. I'm not finding it engaging. I'm not finding it Star Trek-y. As a gameplay experience, I find it pales significantly compared to Imperium. As a way to instantiate the Star Trek theme, I don't find it particularly compelling, even when compared to other Star Trek games. Like Star Trek Frontiers, I think, is a very good Star Trekification of a very good game design, that being Mage Knight, of course. And I don't think the Captain's Chair does a great job of getting its own identity. And so it's mostly just kind of cumbersome combo building.
Yeah, because it's Star Trek. Literally all of Star Trek. They had like zero focus. It's like all time periods, all movies, all captains.
And they're not going to give us James Kirk. Like, if you're going to do that, right? Yeah. If you're going to pull that crap and span everything from like 50 years of network television, why are you not giving me Kirk? Obviously, they're saving him for the expansion. That's like so transparently obvious, I think. But it's just incoherent and incohesive.
I guess it's all over the place. You're trying to search for certain cards, but they have so many that who knows where they're going to be.
As a wise alien once said, Mark and Walker playing Captain's Chair. Shaka when the walls fell.
Shaka when the walls fell.
Also, there's this strange focus. Like, again, just there's a number of ways in which it does not feel like Star Trek. But one way in which it really doesn't feel like Star Trek is you spend all this time trying to acquire cargo. And, like, there's this cargo deck of just interesting objects and weird items that have shown up at various Star Trek.
Random ship parts.
Yeah.
And like, or phasers and or...
It's like, here's a Batleth, here's a photon torpedo, here's a whatever. It's like, okay, I guess whatever. And the thing that I kept thinking was Carno Go Space, Cargo Road.
Boo.
No?
No.
Just as a note, my objection is substantive. It was not just trying to get me there. It just, I got there organically.
I wish they do have all these sort of scientific cards that are like anomalies and stuff. I just wish that they went out on the board, much like the planets, and you had to work towards rectifying those as opposed to just beaming people to planets for whatever reason.
You don't beam people to planets. You beam people to ships. You beam them from your hand or your play area to a ship. People don't show up on planets. Away teams show up on planets.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, away teams. You keep trying to send away teams to planets.
Well, no, because you have a beam somebody to the ship. It's like, oh, does that mean that Riker's going to go to this planet? No, no, no. That just means he's going to set a console somewhere forever.
But you can beam ships to ships, and you can beam... There's no limit to what you can beam to ships.
Well, it's like a Russian nesting doll. You just keep beaming them in, right?
Yeah. So weird.
I, for one, am very disappointed. I came in with relatively high expectations, admittedly. But as both a Star Trek fan and a fan of the work of Nigel Buckle and David Tsertsay, I have no independent interest of going back to Star Trek Captain's Chair again.
We got Keyflower back to the table. But this time we played the Merchant's Expansion. It's designed by Sebastian Bleasdale and Richard Breeze. And put out by R&D Games. It is an auction game at its core. And it's done in colors of meeples. And it's very sort of strategic in that way. Because once you start something in red, be it, one of your own tiles that you already have in place, be it a tile that's in the market to be bid on. Once a color's there, then you can only use that color to outbid or even activate the tile. And so the first meeple to activate it is one. Then you need two more meeples to activate it. So there's all this counterplay and locking things down. It's like, well, I'm going to activate that with red. Now, if someone wants to even bid on it, now they have to bid it on red. So there's lots of back and forth like that. Very interesting.
Adds further tension to the impetus of placing early, right? There were a number of occasions where I desperately needed some effect, and I chose to get it by activating some other person's tile. And they'd been banking on activating their tile later, but they didn't have the necessary color available. So I show up in yellow. They don't have any yellow, and suddenly they're locked out of that tile. Now, granted, that was not an example of deliberate blocking on my part, but the reason why I had to show up early was because I knew I couldn't contest in any given color. And so that adds to the tension and decision-making about what to do with your turns.
Yeah, you're also bidding on turn order for the next round because you get to see... sort of the currency that you're going to be able to get for next round, be it meeples or, skill tiles. And so are you going to waste meeples there? If you're outbid, you can move it around.
Walker says waste. Walker never bids on the drafting tiles.
Exactly.
He just never does.
Only I did.
You did it once.
Once so I could get first pick in the last round, game. Yeah. But that's that. Always love Keyflower.
So this was with the merchants. So there are two big expansions for Keyflower, and then there's about a dozen or more promos.
Yeah, it was 18.
Yeah. So there's the farmers, which introduces animals, and it's not entirely unlike the way animals are handled in your standard Uwe Rosenberg game. You need to have somewhere to put them. They breed under the same conditions as they do in a Rosenberg game, broadly speaking. And there are a variety of different tiles that either give you animals or help you move animals around or give you bonus points for animals in various places. The merchants adds two things. It adds contracts, which honestly, by now, at the time they weren't innovative. In 2014, it's not like it was the first time anyone had had, sock away these resources to get bonus points. But by now, it's, just bog standard. Just have these resources at the end of the game, cash them in with your contract, you get points. Additionally, though, they can be cashed in early to get some bonus resources, which is nice. It gives you a little bit of extra flexibility. And the other thing that it adds is these tile improvements. It effectively allows you to upgrade a tile twice. The sum and substance, the net effect of all these things in the merchants, is that it really doubles down on emphasis about the tiles that you have and what you're doing with them. Because you can make them better, you can make them be worth more points, and there's no extra other element like the animals to worry about in terms of extraneity. So the quality of your village can go up considerably by virtue of playing with the merchants. And generally speaking, I find the scores to be relatively higher as a consequence. It's less flavorful than the farmers is, but by the same token, it does less violence to the core game. And that violence isn't necessarily the right term. It doesn't change the core game as much. The general impression of the table, though, is they seem to prefer the merchants considerably to the farmers. What was your impression, Walker?
I like the contracts because it lets you do a little bit more calculations at the end. It's like, well, I can use this to get, 5 or 6 points to, but that would take a lot of manipulation, moving them around my board, getting them to the place where they need to be. Or I could just have it at the end of the game and get 7 points for fulfilling this contract. It also
incentivizes you to use certain meeples in your own village, because a lot of these contracts are have certain number of meeples, and you don't have any meeples at the end of the game unless they're on your own board, which is another sort of strategy in the game, which is very interesting. So the more you activate your own stuff, the more meeples you're going to get for the next turn, plus the ones you, the boat you bid on. So yes, lots of interesting things going on. The problem with merchants, I shouldn't say the problem because it's like a bad thing, the thing to look out for in merchants is when you triple upgrade a building, because it will double the points that it's worth, those tokens are colored. So yeah, like we said, it's now going to lock the color of that tile to that particular color. So if you put a red upgrade on it, now you can only play red meeples on it. So you better make sure you have the right meeples, or you're not going to be able to, or you don't care about activating that building at all. Anyway.
Yeah. Keyflower, I think, is one of the best heroes of the 21st century in terms of its perennial qualities of having a lot of the same fundamental hero appeals of quality worker placement and auction, but at the same time, doing novel things with them all in a delightful visual package. And so it's very, very quintessential hero as far as I'm concerned, but novel at the same time. And I enjoy having access to the expansions because sometimes you want to play with the farmers, sometimes you want to play with the merchants, sometimes you want to play it plain. Very seldom is it the case in my experience, again, that everyone mixes everything together and just plays them as they come up. Because if you're going to play with the animals, you want there to be a reliable way to get animals. If you're going to play with contracts, you want to make sure that the contract tiles come out so that people have access to contracts. So, but as it is, I'm very happy with the way that it's shaken out. And I personally, it's my favorite of the key games. It's a long-running series, and there are a lot of games in the key series. And I just find it delightful, both in terms of play and in terms of visuals. That is key.
And pace. Only lasts four turns.
It's true. It is absolutely one of those zeros where after the first round, you're like, how am I going to get anything done? I'm not going to have time to do anything. And you get enough done by the end of the game. That is Keyflower the Merchants by Sebastian Bleasdale and Richard Breese, 2014.
Lastly from me, we played Rush MD.
Designed by Anthony Haugigo, Konstantinos Kikinis, and David Tertze.
It's a real-time cure the patients game, much like they've already done Kitchen Rush, which you're working in a kitchen trying to get as many dishes as you can. This is you're working in a hospital. Patients come in, either serious or mild, and you have to get them to their beds. You have to get them their medicine. You have to make sure your medicine cabinet keeps stocked. You got to go to the grocery store, make sure you have enough kidneys and hearts.
No, that's not.
And that's where get that stuff, isn't it? I
don't know.
Oh, the butcher. You go to the butcher and you get your kidneys and your hearts.
Yeah.
Keep them in the fridge in case the patients need them. Hope an epidemic doesn't break out.
Yeah, well, we didn't play with epidemics.
You got helicopters you got to run around the room with.
I couldn't help but notice that the epidemic deck was still sealed.
And all of your worker, you're doing all this with sand timers. You have a doctor sand timer and some nurses, and they're all being flipped around to do all these different actions. You have a helicopter where you balance a sand timer on it while you run around the room to different spots of the table.
Yeah, I was unprepared for how much toy factor there is in Rush MD. So the helicopter is a promo. We didn't play with that either. You're specifically instructed that you have to set up the remote helipad at least 5 feet away from wherever the admitting area is. You have to balance your doctor on the helicopter, and so it adds a dexterity element. When you're operating on organs, whenever you use organs or move them around, you have to do it with tweezers. If you're injecting a patient that's an outpatient, they just need a quick shot of some drug, that's fine. You just take a little piece of wood, put it into an actual plastic plunger thing that's standing in for a syringe. There's no needle, but it's actually got the plunger bit. That's fine. But if they need the drug administered during surgery, whoa, well then, you're not allowed to touch the drug. You have to do that with the tweezers. And so there are these lovely little toyetic factors all over the place. There are these cardboard beds, and you're chucking all the, you chuck the patient in the bed, and anything they need to be treated with, you're throwing in the bed and moving the bed around as they're going from imaging over to surgery back into the ward. There's a lot of toy factor, and I was very pleased by that.
Yeah, all sorts of little mini games, like, oh, they need to, you know, be diagnosed, you know, an x-ray or a culture or blood work, and there's all these different mini games that you do in order to get those diagnosis, and you throw that card in their bed, and that adds more medicine or stuff you need to do to that patient. Overall, I've always loved Rush MD.
I would be very much interested in trying some of the modules, trying some of the epidemic effects, because I found, despite the fact that there was a profusion of sub-mechanisms, I had no difficulty remembering how they all worked in the middle of play. The rulebook is a little daunting, right? There's, you know, page upon page upon page of components. Like, well, this deck, it works like this, and this other deck works like this, and this other deck works, and I'm like, ah. But when you're actually playing the game, everything's really smooth, which is important. If you're going to have a real-time game, whether it's co-op or competitive, but especially if it's competitive, it is important that you don't need to pause for rules explanations too much. And every individual thing is very easy to explain. It's like, wait, how do I pull this card again? Flip over tiles until they match. Okay, good. We're off. And I just want to say, I think that many of our patients were churlish for objecting to their over-treatment. There's one individual who got, you know, a bonus kidney or two, and they have the audacity to complain.
Well, we had the extra medication in there as well. You know, yeah. About four or five extra syringes in order to keep them sedated.
I thought it was a bonus. It was like a combo deal, right? Exactly. They needed a heart and two bones and a couple of pills. I gave them some free injections and some livers, and they complained. Patients these days.
Selfish.
Bunch of crybabies.
Rude.
So that's RushMD. Very eager to play again. Very eager to try some of the modules. This was clearly a design team that loved just playing around with stuff and throwing more toys at the wall. And I'm certain that there are modules and configurations that don't work, that are unwieldy, the combination's not so great, like, well, certain strong. I wouldn't be remotely surprised. But as it is, the core game is very toyetic, and the expansion modules are clearly with that in mind. You know, a sense of play, a sense of joy, let's play around with some components and some toys. And that is absolutely what I want out of a hobby game now and then. And it's just a really interesting co-op element on top, because you have to work on this. There's this weird sort of broadly systemic triage that works, because there's a very limited ability to admit patients, and then there's the surgery bottleneck, and it's well done.
This is what I'm looking forward to. This is Artipia. And so there's a crowdfunding Artipia that I crowdfunded. It's about firefighting. And same thing, high toy factor. You're moving around these fire engines around the city, fighting fires, saving people, trying to keep your water levels up. You have fire extinguishers, lots to it. Hasn't fulfilled yet, but it'll be just as fun, I'm sure. Looking forward to that.
So between of the small child ideal professions, right? Doctor versus firefighter. There are others, but doctor versus firefighter, you'd pick firefighter over doctor?
I think so.
That makes sense. You are fundamentally a jock. I'd pick doctor.
Definitely not a cook.
I said amongst small child ideal professions, I don't know that cook quite makes it. We have baby animal doctor at the top.
Yes.
G.I. Joe is right up there, right? So a lot of people want to be baby animal doctors.
Professional hockey player.
Professional sports player of some kind, right? I suspect now there's a saddening number of children who would include influencer on that title.
I threw up on my mouth.
Yeah, we're getting to move back. Do you know what? We might need a doctor on this.
RushMD.
Those are the games we played this week. Now a quick break while we pay some bills.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. Prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
And we're back, and on to the news, and why it doesn't matter. Walker, what do you got for us this week?
Well, Yokohama Duel was supposed to come out, and TMG had issues, so we didn't see many copies, but Synapsis Games has decided to put out a second edition of Hisashi Hayashi did Yokohama, and he's also doing Yokohama Duel, so it'll be out again. Looking forward to that, like a specifically two-player version of Yokohama.
Also, Mark, you and I have played a lot of Helldivers 2. They have announced... It's not my version of Helldivers
2. Well, why don't you tell the listeners about your idea of what a Helldivers 2 board game would be like?
Well, it would be a great dexterity game, and you could have all these, like, cool elements. Like, you have a bunch of, you know, cubes and a tube, and you, like, wave it above the table, and they all fly out. All these different, or you could have all the tokens that are different arrows, and you have to arrange them in the different stratagems quickly. And you have all these different mechanisms that you're going to use for dexterity elements and flicking and knocking down the aliens. Dexterity Helldivers 2.
Absolutely. This is important. For those of you that are unfamiliar with the Helldivers video game franchise, a lot of it is about tragicomedy and the humor of absurd violence misapplied. Because it's about air power, relentless air power being deployed against an overarching alien enemy. And it is difficult to apply that power precisely. It's a lot of power, but precision isn't its bag. And that obviously lends itself to a variety of dexterity elements. And I think Walker's design suggestions are brilliant. But instead of getting that, we instead have... This is a Sony game, so naturally the license is going to go to Steamforged Games. So yay.
Yeah, it'll be... I move two spaces, and now we'll roll some dice to shoot my gun.
Yeah, yeah.
Pass.
I have zero hope for it. Steamforged Games has been relentlessly mediocre, and they just gobble up licenses. I couldn't help but notice, as a news item, that CMON has announced that they expect to be taking a loss this year of in excess of $1 million. And I can't help but wonder if it's because the glory days of CMON getting big-name licenses running $4 to $5 million Kickstarters has passed because a lot of the oxygen has been sucked up by companies like Steamforged and others that get these big-name licenses in a way that CMON doesn't anymore.
It's true.
Not that I'm saying that CMON would have done a stellar job of Helldivers 2. They might have, though. Sometimes they did interesting stuff.
Things I do like to see is when older games, these aren't that old. Let's not go over the top. But when older games get expansions, because there are like people that are dedicated or really love a certain game, lots of people like Inish.
Yes.
Inish is now going to get a new expansion that will have several different modules in it. So new content for Inish. Happy for the people that love that game. Same with Tiletum. I'm sure I talked about this, but I looked it up. I didn't see it anywhere because I know I saw the images for it before. Tiletum is also going to be getting an expansion called Prospect for Silver. It's a little bit more recent game. It's a tea game from Board and Dice. I very much enjoyed it. I still have it. So glad it's getting an expansion as well.
Sometimes I drop a board game component and it doesn't land on the floor because it's just landed on my protuberant gut. Then I have a Tiletum.
Why do you do this? Who made you like this?
I can't stop, Walker. I have a disease. Finally, just another reminder that if you are a patron of Sober Wrong About Games, you have access to early registration to SwagCon, July 25th, 26th, and 27th in Kingston, Ontario. Non-patrons will have their chance to register very soon. But early registration is open now. I'm really starting to look forward to this, Walker.
I agree.
This is going to be, I think, the Congrès Sauver Wrong About Games fun times, good vibes only, trans rights or human rights board game jamboree. I think it's going to be a great time.
For those Patreon users, you'll just go to the Patreon page and you'll buy a post and you will be registered for the con.
That is the news, and why it doesn't matter, we now move on to our feature game. Our feature game is Ascending Empires Zenith Edition. Ascending Empires was originally published in 2011. Yes, it's difficult to believe. Board games were being published in 2011. We have archaeological records to this effect. And it was published by Z-Man Games, Z being the eponymous Zev Schlesinger, also of Play to Z.
It went Stick, Stick, Rock,
yeah.
Then Ascending Empires.
It was the second game ever
second
made?
Second game.
Oh, okay. I remember back in my day, we had the Jacks, and we had the Ball, and we had the Mancala, and that's what we called board games.
Nice.
So Ascending Empires Zenith Edition is a reworked version of that same sci-fi game, now being published by Play to Z, which is Zev Schlesinger's new outfit, fulfilled in 2024 after successful crowdfunding. Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Ascending Empires Zenith Edition?
So what you're doing is a game that combines things that are not normally combined, Mark. We have a action selection that is very tight and consequential, mixed with dexterity elements. So you're making these action choices. Am I going to build? Am I going to do something? And then you actually have to flick There is options in the game that you don't have to do the flicking part. But essentially, you're flicking across this large neoprene mat. There's all these disc, planet discs that are holed through the whole map. So you're trying to avoid those. You're trying to avoid hitting temple ships, other player ships. Lots going on. Very much enjoyed all of my plays of Ascending Empires.
So the original edition in 2011 was one of the very, very, very few at the time, quote-unquote, serious hobby games. Not that I necessarily like that designation, but game that was appealing to a relatively hardcore hobbyist audience that included dexterity elements. At the time, that was considered far more iconoclastic and, quite frankly, daring from a design idiom than it is now. And it was primarily held back, in many people's estimation, by component problems. It was a puzzle board that came in 9 cardboard panels that you fit together with puzzle pieces, and most copies ended up with 1 or 2 problematic seams. Some were worse, some were better. There were very small people who lucked out and had no problematic seams. My copies, I had 2 different copies at 2 different times. They both had 1 problematic seam. There were a variety of workarounds around this. A common house rule that I saw mentioned a couple times was anytime you're flicking across a board, you can replace it with a glass bead, because glass beads didn't have the problem of going flying when they would hit a problematic seam. They'd just glide right over, whereas the wooden spaceship tokens would have a bit of a problem. There were some people who were very, very dedicated players of Ascending Empires who would make their own wooden boards, very much like you would make your own crokinole board, you know, sand it down, get the right holes done. At the time, though, it was observed, everyone knew that a custom neoprene mat would solve the problem. Like, it was relatively straightforwardly obvious that that's what it was. But I can assure you that, certainly based on my perspective back in 2011, the idea of a hobby game like this having a custom neoprene mat was outlandish in the extreme. It, like, nobody was saying, why didn't you include a neoprene mat? The discourse was, shame we couldn't have had a neoprene mat. And by we, they meant the industry, right? It just wasn't doable. And so, in many ways, Ascending Empires in 2011 was ahead of its time. Now, I would say that Ascending Empires Zenith Edition is a board game very much of its time. And one of the indicia of that, I would say, is the neoprene mat.
Not only that, it's sort of 3 games in one box. Because not only can you play the new updated Zenith Edition of Ascending Empires, they included the Classic Edition. They also included a game called Cosmic Couriers, which is sort of like a game you can play with your children. It's sort of like a mini game where you can flick across the map and you know deliver goods. I haven't looked into it very much, but I'm going to check it out. It's also like a whole solo campaign mode that looks very interesting that I might try as well.
And a whole bunch of modules. Many, many modules.
Many modules to try. So what they've done...
Is that how you say that word? Okay.
So what they've done, like Mark said, there's not one neoprene mat, but 2. So you sort of line them up. In all the games that we've played, there was never a problem with the seam down the middle.
Not a one.
Everything glided across just fine. Nice and colorful. And so what you're doing is, on your turn, you're choosing an action. You're either going to move, or you're going to deploy some troops, or you're going to build. Moving will allow you to flick a couple of ships across if you have them on the board. If you collide with other ships, they'll be destroyed. And if your goal is to try to destroy other ships, you want to get just close enough. There's this range ruler. Token.
Range ruler.
Yeah, ruler makes it sound as though it's big. Because this thing is not big. It is a token.
Fair enough.
This little cardboard rectangle that, you know, along its short side is short range and has a long range for other things in the game. There's also a whole sort of tech system as well. Lots to like. Let's talk about some stuff.
Let's talk about some stuff. I think there are 2 major differences from the base game of Ascending Empires to now the Zenith Edition. And I think they're mostly for the good. And one of them relates to how most turns now have a fair degree of greater flexibility. Back in the day, back when I was young,
In the before times,
when all we had were landlines, Walker, can you believe it? Back in the distant time of 2011. On your turn, if you did a move action, you flicked twice, and that was it. And now there are additional elements that really give you a tremendous degree of flexibility. One of them is maneuvers. Whenever you are engaging in a turn for, with movement, you get any number of maneuvers for free before, during, or after these various actions. So, for example, if you have a ship in orbit around your planet, you can reposition it for free if you're doing a move action. You can land for free. You can take off for free. You can get a bonus flick for free in some context if you're orbiting the right kind of thing. There's a whole bunch of stuff you just get to do gratis. And this can really extend the flexibility of what you're doing and allows you to play around more with some of the techs. More on that later. The other element of flexibility is energy. Because another thing that would happen very often in a game of Ascending Empires, and it still happens in Zenith Edition, is you line up, you get up from your chair, you walk over to the right quadrant. You need to go do that short flick. You flick into that planet, and you just woof it. You're just a little bit short, and you feel like a complete moron. You need to go 3 whole centimeters, and you only went 1. Or, just substitute that for inches for our freedom-loving audience. Or it was the case that you walker the shot and bounce off the planet, and you're just outside of orbit. In normal Ascending Empires, that action just wasted, it's gone, whatever, good luck next turn. Now you can spend energy to buff or increase most turns, and that kind of takes the edge off. For the most part, I think that's a good change.
And it leads to this great sort of decision space, is that you can take a move action, and you get to flick all these ships, you get to move around orbit and realign things, move your star bases, you know, turn guys into ships, land on planets, lots to do. Compared to if you take a build action, you get to build one structure on one planet. It is so limiting, and that's such a tough choice. That's why I really enjoyed it. I'm glad that they did that. I'm glad they made it such a difficult choice to make. Am I going to take my whole turn to build that? Because that's what leads to points. Maybe they wanted to push players more towards the fighting and the flicking, and that's why they made it such a difficult choice to make.
Well, they wanted to make it so that everybody had, I think, at least one turn to mess with your building plans, because you have to set everything up and then in a later turn build things. However, I've got 2 minor gripes with the way building is handled in the Zenith Edition. Number one, it does really feel like you can have a fun turn or you can have an effective turn. Because building, as you say, tends to be worth a lot of points. It sets you up for a lot of great things. It's very important, and it lets you bootstrap into very, very lucrative turns. It doesn't feel very satisfying to spend your entire turn replacing a dude with an outpost. Nothing immediately happens. Meanwhile, your friend over there during their turn gets to flick 5 times and destroy a whole bunch of robots, discover new tech, and get a bunch of new toys. Because of the way energy and maneuvers work. So there's that. The other problem is that the whole interact turn, this is an entirely new thing. This didn't exist in the base game. And this is not me saying it was better before. Let me be very clear. I think the Zenith Edition is an improvement in every way over the base game. I think the base game was an excellent proof of concept now, but the Zenith Edition is the way to go. In the interact turn, you basically can do a whole bunch of miscellaneous leftover stuff. Claim a victory objective that you're qualified for, use some tokens you might have found, get new tokens, things of that nature. These turns can sprawl all over the place. And my problem with them is not so much about the efficiency, not even so much about downtime, because there's not a whole lot of downtime in Ascending Empires. It's just that they make all the other turns look stupid in comparison, right? It's like, okay, I've got a couple tokens in front of me that I just picked up organically over the course of my turn. All right, I'm going to activate this one. This allows me to deploy 2 ships and do 2 flicks. Okay, I'll spend an energy. Cash in another token. Oh, this allows me to flick some more with a bonus to my attack. Oh, and then I'll spend another energy. Oh, this lets me get to build at the end. Like, wait, what? Suddenly you're taking 5 turns at once, and it makes all the other turns look unsatisfying in comparison. It's weird.
Sometimes the energy is a little hard to control because it's very hard to sort of cycle that energy. It's sort of like I use it, it slides down, then you need to slide it back up so you can use it again. And usually the only way you can do that, there are other ways, but the main way is to either build a city or to build a space station. And sometimes that can be difficult to do. So a lot of turns you're sitting there with no energy. So it's a lot about timing. I really loved our most recent game where...
I hated it. You were there.
That hurt. If it wasn't, like, if you were somebody else, like someone I actually cared about, that would actually hurt.
Oh.
But thankfully, it's you.
I feel better now.
I love the puzzly bit that I had to go through a lot of times, because the only way you can unlock more troops is by putting out cities. And the only way you can unlock more ships is to put out space stations. So you're constantly at this back and forth where I can't deploy more
units because I don't have them available, or I can't deploy more ships. So you're taking this maneuver and you're landing troops, and suddenly you'll have more troops and a ship will come back, and now you can deploy that ship because now it's available. So this puzzly bit of maneuvering guys around and using it with your player board, really enjoyed that.
There's a traditional kind of dance that a lot of Euro-style games have with respect to efficient turn planning and conflict. This is what Antica does. This is what Imperial does. This is what Scythe does to a certain extent. And that is, you're off doing your Euro-y thing. And in the context of Ascending Empire Zenith Edition, it's discovering the new planets, building up your buildings, trying to deal with your energy problems, trying to deal with your supply problems, all of those things. But at the same time, you only get to do that on your terms when your borders aren't being threatened by somebody else, right? In the context of Ascending Empire Zenith Edition, you have this interesting little tactical ordering puzzle. It's like, I don't want to do that because I don't have enough energy, but I don't want to do the thing with the energy before I replenish all my energy, but I don't want to build that because I don't have the supply, etc., etc., etc. But the moment an enemy ship shows up in your sector, all of that changes, because now you're looking around at your research stations that are very, very difficult to defend, and you're thinking, well, I can't do the thing I really wanted to do anymore. Now I have to deal with this thing. Okay, and now there's an additional sub-puzzle about how to do this problem as optimally as possible, even though it's not on your terms. And that, I think, is very well done. It's a dynamic that I like in a lot of other Euros. It's not a dynamic that everyone loves, but when it's done well, I really enjoy it, and I think Zenith does it pretty well.
Another thing to go back with the buildings is that they've tied in the technology with the buildings. And the fact that there are four different types of planets, and in order to sort of engage with the technology thing, you have to build, like Mark just said, the research stations on the planet. So that takes your build action. Not only that, they have no defense value. So they're not helping you when those enemy ships come in. They're not helping you with that. But you want to get the techs are very useful. So if I build a research center on a pink planet, now I'm at level one pink. And not only that, if I'm the first one there, I'll get victory points. So there's this push and pull. There are, like I said, four different planets, so four different types of tech and four tiers of each of those techs. And there's an A side or a B side. So lots of different variety. The level three of all those techs is going to introduce a new ship that you get to deploy. And they have all sorts of different abilities, like taking over other ships, being able to deploy anywhere on the board, all sorts of interesting things that you get to do.
They're super cool. In the base game, in the original version, the techs were very different, and there was only one set of them. And indeed, the level three red tech was the only one that gave you a new ship. Whereas in Zenith Edition, there's new ships at every level. And it was overpowered. It dominated the game because in the original version, it was the only ship with a two firepower built in. So it could show up and kill things by itself. Most of the time in Ascending Empires, if you want to kill anything, you either need a bonus from a tile. Again, I'm not a huge fan of those turns involving lots of tiles. Or you need to outnumber the thing you're trying to kill. You want to go kill a starship? Well, you need two starships within short range. Want to go dive bomb a planet? You're going to need at least two ships most of the time, unless you have completely undefended research stations, in which case you can't do that to your nerds. You can't leave your nerds out to dry. Helldivers 2 knows this. Everybody knows this. They can't defend themselves. They got noodly arms. They can't fight back. But anyway. So the new level 3 ships are great. Now everyone gets to play with ship technology, and the new ships I don't find as completely overpowering as the original level 2 battleship was. I do, however, have one minor preference for the original version in one way only. It was an awkward rule. It was difficult to enforce. It was a little thorny to enforce. But the rule was you could only have one planet across your entire empire with more than one research station. What that meant was getting to those higher level of techs was hard. You had to push out and explore. And there were lots of skirmishes, I remember, in the original version, precisely driven by that restriction. People were constantly had to expand their borders because they wanted access to the new techs. Here in the Zenith Edition, I actually find getting the techs to be a touch too easy. I wish there'd been a little bit more difficulty in getting there. Part of that, I think, is because a planet with one research station on it is worth the same number of points to an opponent as a planet with three research stations on it. And maybe if they were a little bit of a better target, you'd be more incentivized to go kill them, and therefore there'd be a greater risk in building more of them. I don't know.
I think there is, because those planets that have three research stations on it took three turns from that planet.
I'm not suggesting that three research stations is the obvious way to
go. No, but I just mean even one or two That's like anything that destroys buildings is an entire turn you've just taken away from your opponent.
Not really, because they've still got the text. They've still got the points that they did to get there. So maybe they're not going to make the push to four. Maybe they'll just settle with the two or three they've already got and move on to something else. I'm just saying that there might well be, as you say, a policing reason to go and kill those research stations. But between a policing reason and a natural incentive for me to go do the thing, I will always prefer the latter as opposed to the former.
True. Plus all the goal cards sort of incentivize you to push into your opponent's area, because almost all of them are to build these things in your opponent's sector.
That's fair. It's just I remember there being a much greater hurdle, a much greater challenge, a sense of satisfaction about getting those higher techs in the original Ascending Empires. In Zenith Edition, I find it comparatively a little too easy. That's all.
Speaking of things that are hard and a hurdle, let's talk about setup quickly.
Ugh.
Because what a pain.
Yeah.
They gave you these nice trays, has all your stuff. You take the tray and then you dump everything out and then you slot everything in your board.
I would recommend not dumping it. There's too many things.
I made the great comparison, which I think is apt. If you look at Andromeda's Edge or
Dwellings of Eldraveil.
Dwellings of Eldraveil, the tray is also your player board. So you just move it to your area, you take off the lid. You might have to make a couple adjustments, but it's ready to go. I really wish they had done that. I think they could have as well, and it wouldn't have been that more difficult.
By itself, it's not the end of the world, but when you add on the fact that you need to set up the planets, randomize the sectors, then make the appropriate pool of discovery tiles, which is shockingly difficult. I haven't found a good way to organize them very easily, so I end up resorting them every time. Then randomizing them and putting them out in the appropriate sectors. It's a little unpleasant, frankly. It's not the end of the world. It's not the most cumbersome setup I've experienced recently, but you're right. With a little bit of inspiration from other player trays, it could have been easier.
And then you got to put it all away at the end as well.
Then you all got to... It's true. Which also, I think, dovetails in with the length. I think Ascending Empire Zenith Edition is a touch longer than it wants to be. Again, the original design was very much of its time, and so it was roughly... you know, an hour with two players, maybe an hour and 15 to an hour and a half with three, and maybe getting closer to 2 hours with four. And Zenith Edition is more or less that length. And it's not particularly overlong, but I would have appreciated a little bit of time shaved off, frankly. Because, again, you do spend a lot of those turns doing things that are very advantageous but unsatisfying. And so I think it might have been able to be condensed to a quicker, more visceral experience.
I do think it moves at a good clip. And I do think that there should not be a lot of AP, because what you need to do or should do is fairly apparent, and you will have time to, you know, decide. I can't see people coming to their turn and not knowing what they want to do.
That's fair. It's just the last few turns of Ascending Empires, seldom do I feel like I'm racing to go do that one last thing. And very often I'm looking at the supply of victory points, which determines the length of the game, and say, oh, there's about four or five left. Okay, where's some low-hanging fruit I can go get? Which is not how I like an endgame to be driven, frankly. Yeah. And so in that sense, the arc, I think, would benefit if the supply were just a little bit lower.
Yeah.
I might try just trying to sketch out for future games where and when that pool runs out and where I think the pool ought to have run out and see if there's an easy formula for reducing the victory point pool. I don't know. Maybe there is. Maybe there isn't.
So lots of modules that you can play. It has this Guardian warships that feel a lot like the ships that are in Eclipse. You know, you flip a tile, you know, this...
they just wait around to die,
this giant ship will show up, and you go up, you kill it, you get a bunch of bennies pop out. There are Empire cards, which give you, special powers, alien powers. Sublight movement, which is that thing I talked about, you know, not having to flick, you know,
if you don't want to play the game.
If you don't want to play the game properly. Ancient libraries, which we haven't tried yet.
No. If you don't play a dexterity game, more power to you.
Yeah.
But if you don't want to play a dexterity game, don't play Ascending Empires.
Yeah, there's lots of other games out there.
Yeah.
Ancient libraries, which you didn't play. Yet another module. Megastructures, we did play with. A little disappointed with the fact that... I love the fact that there are different megastructures that you can do. Disappointed with the fact that they only came with four.
Three.
Even worse. There could have been a lot wider range of different things that the mega structures did. So you randomly decide what the mega structures for this particular game are going
to
do.
They decided to add a whole bunch of different possible minor effects to the Zenith Edition. I think I would have preferred maybe one or two modules that had bigger effects. Like, they could have gone... you're right, they could have gone to town on the megastructures. They could have gone to town with how the alien warships worked or something. As it is, I kind of wish they had a little bit more focus. And allowed for slightly more outre effects. Like, the tech effects are really cool. The various techs that you get, some of them are just, you know, means to an end and just necessary to get to the next level. But there's a lot of things on the tech boards where I'm like, yeah, now I get to do this awesome thing. I didn't get that sense from the asymmetric powers or from the megastructures, frankly.
And lastly, there's some proximity mines, which we also didn't play with. They're just these fairly large templates that come in your player tray, and it looks, you'll probably just put them out and it'll block large areas of the thing, help protect your zone.
So all told, to kind of summarize where I am with the Zenith Edition, I'm pleased with it, but I think to a large extent, whereas the base game was ahead of its time, as I say, this is of its time. We're now in a position where, and I'm very thankful for this, that quote-unquote frowny, serious hobby games, whatever modifiers you want to apply, I'm not trying to be gatekeepery, I'm just trying to explain how some people view them, take dexterity seriously, and hybridization is a thing that we're more comfortable with. So just thinking about games that have been released since, we're talking about games like the only game that matters, SEAL Team Flicks, whether it's Flick Fleet, For Science, even Rush MD has a dexterity element, Minara, and all the co-op dexterity games that we've had. These are all things that we've had since the 2011 release of Ascending Empires. And so it can't get by on innovation alone anymore. It's got a lot of company. And in that sense, a number of these misgivings that I have make me overall just less enthusiastic with it. I think that at the time it was a genre-defying game. And now there are a lot of sort of middleweight 4X adjacent, not really 4X games that I very much enjoy playing. Again, games like Warpgate, games like Imperium the Contention, all those sub-Eclipse 4X-y kinds of things. And when I look at the field of hybrid dexterity games and of space games, the Zenith Edition just has a lot more competition. And I'm happy to play it, but it is no longer the thing that is so unlike everything else that it used to be. And so consequently, I can't help but feel my enthusiasm has been blunted by that.
Oh, I definitely skyrocketed up into my top 10, I think. I very much enjoy it. I love dexterity games. I love the tightness of the action selection, how you want to do everything. And even within those actions, like, oh, I really need to build, but what do I want to build? I really want to put out the satellites because I'll get more ships. I really want to put out, you know, the research stations because I want these techs. I want to get my cities and my outposts out because it's going to get me more points and help me, because that will allow me to deploy troops on those planets and help me spread out faster. Lots of things going on. I very much enjoyed Ascending Empires.
Yeah, just to make clear how much enthusiasm Walker has, we've for the past few years been mostly successful at keeping to our idea that we should not be duplicating any games in our collection. But after playing the copy of Ascending Empire Zenith Edition that I got, Walker went out and got his own copy.
Yes.
So there you go.
Very much enjoyed it. And I remember distinctly the original version flicking off the board. And in the games that we've played of this new edition, it never happened once.
You, I think, have grown as a dexterity game player. There was a period where you seemed incapable of giving anything other than the Walker 120%. And you would occasionally express grave disappointment at any dexterity game that would not allow you to do that. Now, I think you have learned to appreciate a subtle, softer
subtlety.
Flick. Maybe it was the flicking. Maybe it was the component problems, maybe not. I think this is a you evolution issue rather than an Ascending Empires evolution issue. So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We appreciate your having decided to give us some of your valuable time and attention. We hope to see you again soon. Take care of yourselves, take care of your hobby, and thank your Rules Explainer.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McNeil. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.